One of the amazing things about the internet economy is how different the list of top internet properties today looks from the list 10 years ago. It wasn't as if those former top companies were complacent. Most of them acquired and built products like crazy to avoid being displaced. The reason big new things sneak by incumbents is that the next big thing always starts out being dismissed as a toy. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And we have got a great read today. A little blast from the past. This one is called Why the Next Big Thing Will Look Like a Toy. And it's written by Chris Dixon. Now, I got put onto or directed at, referenced this read from a book, actually, that I was digging into. I've kind of doubled my external to the show book consumption lately. And this was The Cold Start Problem. And it's about a far deeper dive into network effects, what they are, what their limitations are, why they're not just this simple, you know, positive feedback thing. And it was just a good book. And it specifically talked about this article written back in 2010. As an interesting example for how to think about the atomic network and why disruptive technologies are often totally missed by the incumbents. One of the examples I think he gives is how, like, the first video uploaded to YouTube was, I think, I can't remember exactly what it is. It was like the founder of YouTube, like out of zoo or something, and he was in front of an elephant, I think. I can't remember exactly what the details were, but it was like 15 seconds or 30 seconds or whatever. He's like, hey, look at this thing. Okay, bye. And imagine any media company or like major corporation being worried about that when, you know, the level of content at the beginning of YouTube was just nothing. Like, it was just little silly little videos, play like things that some random person just uploads from their house or backyard. But how much attention did it steal? How much content type did it actually open up? So why is that? Why is that distinction there? And I think Dixon does a very interesting job in a very short read, but it sparks a really fun discussion, so I wanted to cover it on this show. A quick shout out to our sponsors, to Swan Bitcoin, the all-encompassing financial services for the Bitcoin world. If you're looking to buy Bitcoin, set up your business, set up your IRA, whatever it is, check it out. Go to Swan. Swan is a wonderful resource for literally anything. They're a great place to start. And then, of course, CoinKite and the Cold Card hardware wallet and the many other Bitcoin security and just like fun devices that they have. CoinKite is amazing. A long-time trusted source for Bitcoin tools, and I highly recommend it if you don't have a Cold Card. I love that freaking wallet. Plus, you can get 9% off. Discount code and link is right there in the show notes. And with that, let's get into today's read. And it's titled, The Next Big Thing Will Start Out Looking Like a Toy, by Chris Dixon, January 3rd, 2010. One of the amazing things about the internet economy is how different the list of top internet properties today looks from the list 10 years ago. It wasn't as if those former top companies were complacent. Most of them acquired and built products like crazy to avoid being displaced. The reason big new things sneak by incumbents is that the next big thing always starts out being dismissed as a toy. This is one of the main insights of Clay Christensen's disruptive technology theory. This theory starts with the observation that technologies tend to get better at a faster rate than users' needs increase. From this simple insight follows all kinds of interesting conclusions about how markets and products change over time. Disruptive technologies are dismissed as toys because when they are first launched, they undershoot user needs. The first telephone could only carry voices a mile or two. The leading telco of the time, Western Union, passed on acquiring the phone because they didn't see how it could possibly be useful to businesses and railroads, their primary customers. What they failed to anticipate was how rapidly telephone technology and infrastructure would improve. Technology adoption is usually non-linear due to so-called complementary network effects. The same was true of how mainframe companies viewed the PC, the microcomputer, and how modern telecom companies viewed Skype. Christensen has many more examples in his books. This does not mean every product that looks like a toy will turn out to be the next big thing. To distinguish toys that are disruptive from toys that will remain just toys, you need to look at products as processes. Obviously, products get better in as much as the designer adds features, but this is a relatively weak force. Much more powerful are external forces. Microchips getting cheaper, bandwidth becoming more ubiquitous, mobile devices getting smarter, etc. For a product to be disruptive, it needs to be designed to ride these changes up the utility curve. Social software is an interesting special case where the strongest forces of improvement are users' actions. As Clay Shirky explains in his latest book, Wikipedia is literally a process. Every day it is edited by spammers, vandals, wackos, etc. Yet every day the good guys make it better at a faster rate. If you had gone back to 2001 and analyzed Wikipedia as a static product, it would have looked very much like a toy. The reason Wikipedia works so brilliantly are subtle design features that sculpt the torrent of user edits such that they yield a net improvement over time. Since users' needs for encyclopedic information remains relatively steady, as long as Wikipedia got steadily better, it would eventually meet and surpass user needs. A product doesn't have to be disruptive to be valuable. There are plenty of products that are useful from day one and continue being useful long term. These are what Christensen calls sustaining technologies. When startups build useful sustaining technologies, they are often quickly acquired or copied by incumbents. If your timing and execution is right, you can create a very successful business on the back of a sustaining technology. But startups with sustaining technologies are very unlikely to be the new ones we see on top lists in 2020. Those will be disruptive technologies, the ones that sneak by, because people dismiss them as toys. This episode is brought to you by Swan Bitcoin. If you haven't bought your Bitcoin yet, or you're not even sure how to get started, there is no better place than Swan Bitcoin. They have a literal treasure trove of resources. Many of them, I even have my own curated list of stuff that I think is the best intro to understand and get the big pieces of where and how to start. And they have a huge database of other curated lists, blog posts, instructions, tutorials, you name it. And then simply getting on the platform using my link at swan.com/guy. Sign up is super quick and you can just start buying Bitcoin. You can do like I do and set up an automatic savings plan that goes automatically to your cold storage. This is the simplest and best way to set up your Bitcoin savings. Like, I have done this with other members of my family who just don't want to get into the constant management and trying to figure it out. And as little as like 10 bucks a week or something. It is literally so easy and it just runs and you don't have to think about it. Then they have tons of other resources for a retirement, to set up an IRA in just a couple of minutes, getting your business on a Bitcoin standard, doing employee benefit plans. They have Swan Private for white glove support if you want to have someone always at your beck and call to ask questions or anytime you feel uncomfortable. Check it out. It is all available at swan.com/guy. The link and details will be right in the show notes. All right. So like I said, this was a really short episode, or excuse me, a really short read. But I think there is a really powerful nugget of truth that is important to expand on and understand, especially in the context of network effects, both from the positive and the negative side, and in understanding how to assess, or maybe not even necessarily how to assess, but how to be ensure that you are not dismissing something incredibly important because you think its use case or what its purpose is right now somehow doesn't fit into your way of life or what you think it's useful for or some utility. Is understanding the process of that thing, the process of that protocol in the development and expansion of that network, and then you can begin to see the bigger picture. But if you do not have that context, that frame of reference to make that assessment, you will necessarily miss the most important things. And I actually got linked to this, or this was very loosely an offhand reference, and I just caught it. I caught it specifically because they just mentioned it twice in the book at two various points, and I caught the name and I realized that I knew the username. I think we have even read something by C. Dixon on the show before, but I was reading the book The Cold Start Problem, which I was reading just after I finished Theft of Fire by Devin Erickson, who we had on the show, by the way. If you haven't listened to that episode, it's a really fantastic interview, and I really, really enjoyed my conversation with him. I'll be sure to link to that one in the show notes, actually. But one of the things that he talks about that I think is really relevant here and also helps to shine a light on kind of why this phenomenon seems to occur is this idea of something called the atomic network. When you have something that is built around network effects, it's generally discussed in a very broad and vague way as if this is some sort of positive for whatever it is. That, oh, well, you know, if you get your friends on it and then you're on it, then the network effects necessarily means it's going to grow and this is why it's going to have a competitive advantage, blah, blah, blah. When in reality is it actually works against you way more than it works for you. Because if the network does not have, quote unquote, an atomic network, a network which is essentially defined as the size of the network and the density of a network that is self-sustaining, how big and how involved does your network have to be for it to survive? Because a great example is Threads or Google Plus or something, where it appears as if there was this flood of users, but somehow the atomic network was never reached. There wasn't any specific value add, and there wasn't enough activity on it. Because at the end of the day, the only reason you go to a social website is A, to interact with other people, but also B, to see what they are posting. So if nobody's posting, if everybody just goes there to consume, to look around at what other people are doing, well, then they'll hang out there for 15 minutes, find nothing, they'll leave, and maybe never come back. That's why I've posted about this on Nostr actually a couple of times, because a lot of people are like, oh, we need to branch out and we need to post a whole bunch of other topics and ideas and, you know, different disciplines and about photography and all of this stuff. And that's great and everything, but we need to focus on the atomic network. The atomic network of Nostr is Bitcoiners. What we actually need to do is attract as many Bitcoiners as we possibly can and talk about those things that are relevant to the Bitcoin culture or that would keep Bitcoiners there and the people that would also keep Bitcoiners there. Because you need a level of network density for it to matter to the people of that network. This is why people still go back to Twitter. Because even as crappy and degraded as that network has become, it's very much done the whole Reddit thing. Twitter has evolved in much the same way, where Reddit just became kind of nonsense. Like, our Bitcoin's just not the place for good discussion or news or anything. And it was kind of the heart of the Bitcoin discussion, so to speak, the public Bitcoin space, back in basically upwards of 2017. It was really during the entire block size war, our Bitcoin subreddit was essentially the place to be for everything centered around Bitcoin. And then it devolved into infighting and just nonsense and memes, and it just degraded. And maybe that's just a pure consequence of it got too big, but I'm not so sure. I think it's just that when new people come in, like, it's just kind of the evolution, not necessarily of its size, but of the quality of people who are there in order to engage in and lead the discussion versus the laggards. I think it's a product of time more than it is scale, and scale just kind of comes with the consequence of time. But regardless, Twitter seems to have suffered the same fate, at least in my opinion. The good discussion is not there anymore, but there's not really a new center. Nostr could be that center, but the problem is the atomic network issue for Nostr is very, very difficult because you need network density. Like, one of the things that they talk about is that, you know, people come up and there's no engagement. You know, somebody from outside of Bitcoin specifically, they only see Bitcoin content and there's no engagement. None of their friends are up there. So they just kind of like look around for a bit and they're like, what is this? They post something, nobody likes it, and then they leave. This is kind of in the nature of how Nostr works. It's a pretty disparate network, which is why if we want to use this to our advantage and think about the atomic network, we need to just get the Bitcoiners over there because we can have very high network density for Bitcoiners. A good example that the cold start problem uses when thinking about network density is two good examples actually are dating websites or dating networks and Uber and, you know, rideshare and delivery networks, those sorts of things. Is if you have, you could have 10,000 drivers, but if you only have 10 drivers in 1,000 different cities, you have a useless network because it means that everybody's going to have hours of wait times. The likelihood of a driver being there or being active at the same time that a rider needs to get taken somewhere is going to be insanely low. But if you have 10,000 drivers in a single city, like if you have 10,000 drivers in Los Angeles, well, then you can hit that atomic network size where there's always going to be some driver nearby in your area that's close enough to pick you up and that the driver would actually be pinged and you would be likely to actually receive a ride or a match, so to speak, within a matter of, you know, 10, 15 minutes. Which is why branching out and being like, we need to get drivers in every single city is a really terrible strategy for building out and maintaining that network. What you need is you need a niche. You need a single network that you can get that network density of. And this goes very much in line with why very disruptive technologies, and particularly network-style technologies, end up looking like toys when they first start off, because it has to focus on one very specific thing. And naturally, the thing that's best to focus on is something that's extremely niche from some other network. So a great example of just thinking about how so many of our network and kind of peer-to-peer sort of, like Uber is clearly not peer-to-peer, but when you think about it in the context of like connecting the driver and the user, it is peer-to-peer, but it's just a centralized organization of the peer-to-peer network. So it's not in structure, but it is in kind, so to speak, when we're talking about users. But what's funny is that Uber was kind of a subset of Craigslist. Airbnb, a subset of Craigslist. Tinder, a subset of Craigslist. You actually have this entire era of these sorts of apps that basically what they did is they took some other kind of like eBay or Craigslist, some other really broad, extremely broad, hyper unfocused classifieds sort of platform. Basically, a ton of it was about how do we take one thing out of Craigslist and give it all of the features that Craigslist doesn't have time to implement because they're trying to do 1,000 things rather than just this one. So rather than just having these vague listings without any pictures or some standard format, and, you know, without being able to integrate a calendar right into it and being able to see a schedule of who's available, and they just like link to an email so that you can contact somebody kind of in the dark. Well, why don't we give this all of the features that we would need for actually renting out a place, knowing when that place is available, pictures and reviews from other people about whether or not this is a good place to stay, give it all of the features about renting a space, and ignore everybody, you know, hiring a handyman or looking for dates or whatever it is on that platform, and just tackle this one problem, make it a completely separate network that just does the job better. We're going to niche down to something very specific, and we'll build an atomic network with that in some specific city, you know, on the West Coast, in a state, whatever it is. And after we do that, if we can manage to keep this alive and build it out in one specific area, it will survive on its own in that area, and it will be the proof of concept that now we can take this to the next big city, and we can do it again, and then we can do it again, and then we can do it again over and over and over again until suddenly you do have, you know, Airbnbs available in 10,000 different cities. But I think the necessity of that kind of, that quote-unquote niching down, of finding that one little corner where this new technology either provides something unique or new, and also specifically grabs someone who's explorative. You know, toys are easier to sell to someone who wants to explore something. And you know, maybe this is a little bit of a bias from my perspective too, is that I just love playing with new technology. But the idea of just having something novel or fun to explore that ends up, again, looking like a toy. It ends up looking like a gimmick, but that showcases the underlying technology, the real power behind the thing that makes it possible. I think that's part of what makes something like that appealing when there's very few people there, or when there's not much infrastructure or platform to do with it. And this is also why Bitcoin has increasingly looked like a toy. I think this is, like, people don't see the fact that it's building out, that the feedback loop for Bitcoin is in making this an indestructible global infrastructure for payments and money, for a monetary consensus that cannot be contested by essentially anyone, not even a powerful nation state. And yet most people seem to see a toy. They see this, you know, silly little point system on the internet. And it's not uncommon that, I mean, I often preface when I'm talking about it to people outside, because I think that's what most people see. Most people see this like, oh yeah, it's an app where you can buy some internet points. And it's just like one particular kind of internet point, and there's tons of different cryptos and all of this stuff. And I think it's completely the wrong framing, and that it actually needs addressing for people to introduce the argument, to basically call it out, because it is so common. But something else that Dixon actually said in this that I thought was interesting is that the tool itself, or the network, whatever it is that we're kind of talking about, is that it needs to ride the wave of some sort of external change. He talked about, like, you know, the growing use of smartphones and the ubiquity of, you know, voice communications, or like whatever it is, that as you see these trends happening, maybe in the hardware or in the platform, something else that would enable this sort of tool to be more widely used, or be more efficient, effective, whatever it is, like an infrastructure being built out for telephone lines, or a higher bandwidth coming that's going to make it clear that telephones can actually go more than just a couple of miles, you know, et cetera, et cetera. That's an interesting element that he specifically mentions in this that lends itself to the idea of timing. Of, are you at the right time for exactly this sort of tool or network to come to fruition? And so an interesting parallel, I think, for today, for something that I think a lot of people just kind of see of like a little kind of a gimmick, or don't quite understand the implications of, is actually Keet. Most people see, they're trying to build a peer-to-peer chat app. And that's real cool. It's a little rough around the edges. You know, it's kind of got some bugginess. Some files don't transfer super well from time to time. But one of the reasons why I think this is such a powerful concept, because the protocol, the chat app is just what can we do with the protocol. But underlying, one of the external factors that I think makes this so powerful is the existence and growing pile of extra devices, of extra bandwidth, of extra hardware, and extra storage that is sitting out there on the internet. And one of the things, like Pair Runtime is going to be released, which is kind of the foundation for Qt. It's going to be completely open source on the 14th of this month. So I'm recording this right now on the 6th, and I think it will come out maybe tomorrow, actually. But Pair Runtime should come out relatively quickly. And I think how that is going to change the nature of what Qt is trying to do, and also the project that myself and Hope, the developer I'm working with, what we are trying to build on top of the underlying Qt, the foundation that Qt is based on as well, is that this is going to be able to make passive nodes that help serve this consistency, both in the files and in the chats, in a far more reliable way. Like the ability to just have a Raspberry Pi that's running with a program, a service in the background that's downloading everything for a conversation and then reseeding it into everyone in the room, and can do so blindly in the sense that they're not able to see what's going on in the conversation. Like messages are propagate incredibly well. Like Qt is my main messaging app. Right now, the big limitation I feel like is files. But there's also something really interesting about Qt, about what they targeted for their application, is it's got a really, really small atomic network. And it's kind of like Zoom. You know, Zoom's atomic network is two people. Is you need someone who needs to make calls and someone who needs to receive calls. And as long as the two of you are using it and you are meeting on a regular basis, that's an atomic network. Zoom is always going to solve that problem for whoever, whatever tiny network can actually utilize this. Qt is actually pretty similar in that way, because right now one of the things I actually use Qt for is to move stuff between devices. Because the underlying protocol is so good at peer-to-peer connections that even in my own home, a lot of the times if I'm just trying to move a image or something quick, I literally can just drop it into a chat that both my AMI machine, my MacBook, and my phone are all in, and then I can download it on the other device. It's a really quick way to, it's become my main private encrypted mode of sharing sensitive data when I'm sharing gift card codes or a password to something for some other device. It's a really handy thing. So honestly, the atomic network for Qt may actually be one, but I'll tell you something that I know it's great for is I have a working group for Bitcoin Audible. Like we do everything out of Qt, and it's just three of us in the media crew my producer and a Merc creative that does all of my branding and graphics and everything now, since I had handed everything over to her. But we have a little group and everything runs through Qt, and that is more than enough to keep a stream of conversation. Like it's a very, very small group, but it's a constant source of, we all have our devices on, and it's a way to stay in explicit touch with each other on all the various things. It's a way to send thumbnails and, you know, graphics back and forth, to share audio files. Now, we still have a specific hosting system. I still use Mega to transfer, quote unquote, more reliably, especially if I'm transferring from my phone, because if I cut my phone off or, you know, put it in passive mode or whatever, I'm not going to be seeding the stuff to the conversation. So if they're not there, then that file is going to be inconsistent. But that's specifically because we don't have the things like Pair Runtime yet until the 14th that would let me have some sort of a device that's always there to download. So I know exactly that I'm uploading to a location. And also the tool that I am working on, that I am having Hope build and am trying to do my part to play in helping to make it possible, is also very much in line with this. But I don't think this protocol would have worked 15 years ago. And it's purely because of, well, I mean, obviously there's a degree of like, you need smartphones for, I mean, you could have done it all on desktop, and my main use of it is actually on desktop. But I think to have a large enough network to, one of the tricks that they have pulled in the protocol is that the messages are actually blind forwarded. So let's say you and I have a room together, and then I have a room with my brother in a different conversation. And, but we are all kind of part of the same network. We just don't have, we all don't have rooms with each other. Well, if I send out a message and you're not online to our room, it actually gets sent to my brother, who holds it in just an encrypted blob that he forwards. And when you come back online, you get the message from my brother, even though my brother can't read the message, and the key is only between you and I. So as the network grows, it gets bigger and more reliable. And the notifications are working really well. Like my wife only has like one room, and it's just like kind of our group, our family group. But she still gets notifications pretty well. She said it's a little bit buggy. She doesn't always get it, but she has essentially the smallest network that she could have on it. She hasn't joined any of like the Pair community room or the Plan B room or the Bitcoin room. She literally has my room, the room that has our stuff in it and that I share our personal family conversation in. So the fact that it works at all, despite the fact that we're almost never online at the same time, is really fascinating. The magic that they have to utilize the broader network is really crazy. But I also just added my desktop, my AI machine into it as a node. And I have a different Linux machine that my AI machine is basically replacing. And I might actually use that for a bunch of like little services and Keet and Hole Punch, like Pair runtime based tools, because there's a lot of things that I want to build on top of this. And it's increasingly looking like the thing that's going to solve so many problems without the hosting issue, without a lot of the limitations that even things like Nostr have, because the relay model is still ultimately centralizing, because there's still this huge distinction and huge difference between the relay and the peer, or the relay and the user, which is just the client server relationship in a different way. It's a slightly different dynamic, but it's still basically the same differences. And so it has the same scaling issue, really, and it also has essentially a lot of the same centralization pressures. But the beautiful thing about Hole Punch and Pair Runtime and these things that are built over in the Keet ecosystem is that they fundamentally just destroy the client-server relationship. There are no clients, there are no servers, everyone is a peer. You can have a degree of like kind of prosumer sort of peer, or you can just have a mobile device that's just going to log in and be a part of the conversation, or share a file or download a file whenever it is that they need to. But ultimately, hosting and participating is no different. They are one and the same. And because of this, it is an insanely powerful tool for moving messages and files. I mean, arbitrary data from one device to another through any sort of network block, through, on your local network, whatever it is, with as absolutely minimal, basically the non-existence of a setup at all. It's just give a link, and now you have a connection, and now you can share what you need to share. And in the context of the next big thing starts out looking like a toy, I'm going to go out on a limb and say that this is a really powerful and really huge thing that I think is going to, I very, very seriously think that it could kick off a new era of the web, a new era in how we think about connections and the sharing and ownership of data. And it starts out looking like just a really simple run-of-the-mill chat app, but it is fundamentally a very powerful and very fascinating underlying technology. But I think there's a lot of things that are happening all at once where essentially the time is right. The technology is aligning, the political pressures are aligning to incentivize and push for people to even take a slightly greater headache in order to get a degree of control and openness in their information flow, the bandwidth around, the more mainstream or establishment means that are trying to choke what we can talk about and how we can talk about it, while at the same time, all of the external like hardware and the map of available devices and the bandwidth capabilities and the access to these things, and you know, the underlying tools like Pair Runtime that ultimately allow any device to be a quote-unquote server and to duplicate or, you know, have 10 different devices spread out all over the place that are all serving something to even a group of people, to thousands, maybe even millions of people into some sort of a stream, so that you essentially can remove server costs and you can treat everything like a BitTorrent seed, so to speak. There's just a lot of really powerful alignment. And then the tools, you know, the AI tools that I talk about on AI Unchained and my other podcast and the YouTube channel that I've been trying to dig into, and the Devs Who Can't Code series that we're starting. Just there's so much aligning that I think it's incredibly important to not dismiss things that look silly or look stupid, because there's some real magic going on. And I think we are in an era that is also increasingly disruptive. There are a lot of things that the internet has not yet disrupted that I think are ripe. And, you know, obviously money and finance is such a huge part of that. But I think that's really part of a larger move, of a larger kind of decentralization and spreading out, this splintering of the data streams and this decentralization of the platforms, of the communities, of the social networks, where Web 2 re-centralized everything. I think we're seeing an era of breaking that down, and all of the pressures and hardware and kind of external conditions necessary to finally reinforce that to where it may actually be sustainable, and it may get away from them much, much faster than they think. So a thank you to Chris Dixon for this article way back from 2010, and I'll recommend The Cold Start Problem, the book that kind of pointed me here, because it's a really fascinating discussion and read on the state and thinking about networks in general and how to build them and what their limitations are, and whether granular understanding of network effects rather than just kind of like broad, vague, hand-wavy bullshit, which is very, very common. So I will have the link to that in the show notes. And I hope you guys are as excited and interested to dig into all of this stuff as me, because I think we're going to deviate a little bit, because there's a lot of things around Bitcoin that I think are going to inform what is happening in the Bitcoin space. And I want to explore more of it on Bitcoin Audible. And I would love to hear from you guys about what you think about that, because obviously this is not a Bitcoin article at all, but I think it ties into so much of what is going on. So let me know. Don't forget to shoot me any feedback. Please share out the show if you know somebody who would be interested in this, or somebody who is starting their journey down the Bitcoin rabbit hole and they want a good resource that's not going to lead them astray. That is what I try to make this show. And somebody recently dropped me a review for AI Unchained. I cannot remember off the top of my head who it was, but it was somebody I recognized and have had conversations with before. But I just wanted to give you a shout out. Thank you so much. That really, really does mean a lot, and it really helps out the show. Leaving a review, sharing this out with people you know, or in, you know, some other Telegram group when it's, you know, relevant to the conversation, or on Noster or on Twitter. These things really do go a long way, and I super, super appreciate it. If I could give you all 100,000 sats for doing so, I would. This show relies on essentially word of mouth expansion and, you know, people passing it through their own networks. So I really, really appreciate the incredible support that you guys have been. And a huge thank you, obviously, to my sponsors as well, to CoinKite, Cold Card Hardware Wallet. I love that thing. I love my tap signer. And of course, Swan Bitcoin. I've been buying with them, I don't know, years since they started it. And they've been a longtime supporter of the show, too. So thank you all. Don't forget to check out the links, sponsors, references, everything in the show notes. And I will catch you on the next episode. And until then, everybody, take it easy, guys. all big things come from small beginnings. The seed of every habit is a single tiny decision. But as the decision is repeated, a habit sprouts and grows stronger. Roots entrench themselves and branches grow. The task of breaking a bad habit is like uprooting a powerful oak within us. And the task of building a good habit is like cultivating a delicate flower one day at a time. James Clear from Atomic Habits.